Hello, and welcome to Androids and Assets, the bi-weekly show where we talk about the political economy of speculative fiction. That is, how decisions are made, conflicts resolved, and what world-shattering truths lay just beyond the confines of the familiar. This week, we are extremely pleased to welcome back to the show return guest, Gautam Bhatia. Adroit listeners will recall that Gautam was on to talk about his first novel, The Wall, and today he's back to follow up us about its sequel, The Horizon, and as also his recent Mint Press short story, A Rumi's Choice. Welcome, Gautam.
Thank you so much. Good to be back.
Thanks so much. It's a great pleasure to speak with you. For those who don't know, that in addition to being twice a novelist, as well as a writer of several short stories and an editor for Strange Horizons, a weekly science fiction publication, he is also a practicing lawyer in his home country of India and has published two nonfiction books about the field.
You're not just a constitutional lawyer in India, though, right? Didn't I see you like arguing in Kenya?
Oh, I wasn't arguing. I wish I was able to, but no, I was an amicus friend of the court for one of their constitutional cases, which actually just got done last week. So I'd filed a brief along with four other of comparative constitutional academics on one of the issues that they were considering, which was on unconstitutional constitutional amendments, because it's an issue that's been considered all over the world. And in fact, it began in India, that idea. So some of the lawyers asked us to file an amicus brief, which we did.
Yeah, fantastic. It just blows my mind of like, yeah, like I'm a lawyer in India, but I also, you know, just pop off to Kenya briefly to...
Well, I wasn't physically there. Just that
no.
My brief was there, yeah.
I guess maybe it's just the reach of the British Empire. It's like...
Yeah. It is. We're all common law countries, similar histories.
The Horizon follows up on The Wall, which is a story about the city of Sumer and its inhabitants who are dealing with the ramifications of the previously titular wall being breached by Militha, a rebel and member of the young Tarafian movement. So yes, so the book follows Melita in her journeys over the wall, as well as the impact on the young Tarafians and the ruling council of Sumer in those tumultuous days. I don't want to spoil. I'm trying not to spoil it. I don't know. It's a great book for us because The Wall was, because it is very much focused on issues of resource management, of law and authority. This book, in many ways, is more procedural than The Wall is, right? Like a lot of the book takes place in very explicit political conversations. We're very interested in it. When we spoke previously about The Wall, we talked a lot about like the antecedents for it and kind of like political crisis in India in, you know, the 80s and 90s. This book, a lot of it deals with not just responding to Melita going over the wall, but it also has to do with land reform issues, right? They're attempting to pass land reform legislation, which, you know, I guess land reform being a huge issue in India right now. was that contemporaneous to when you were writing, or was that just in the water? Like, was it just you saw it looming on the horizon?
This is actually really funny because when I had finished The Horizon and it was all done, there was no sense that this would happen in India. And just around that time, as I had finished and submitted it to my editor, the Indian Parliament, government passed these three farm laws that was effectively an attempt to introduce like capitalism into Indian agriculture, to put it very reductively and very straightforwardly. It's pretty complex. And then you had this huge, huge protest movement by a very large group of organized farmers outside the capital, Delhi. And they were camped there for a whole year. Until the government actually had to take back the laws. And that entire movement was going on while the book was with the editor and getting published. So it was contemporaneous, but it wasn't intentional. Like one thing that the Indian government now does, you know, this present government does, is that you'd have like white papers, parliamentary debate, you know, like standing committees, all of that when you're passing a law. This government doesn't believe in any of that. So it'll be in the list of business for next year's parliament. Suddenly you'll have like these laws appearing, and overnight they'll get passed. So nobody really gets any warning about that this law is going to be on the horizon. So in that way, it wasn't anticipated. So I had no way of knowing this would happen, or that this massive farmers movement would happen. It just happened to be exactly the same
literally, literally one of the biggest protests in the history of the world would happen because of
the biggest and most long lasting because they were protesting for a whole year.
We even felt it in Canada because people were like the expatriate community where we live in Alberta were very active in lobbying.
Yeah, it was a very active Sikh protest in India, and the Sikhs of course are. Active community in Canada. So and of course the Indian government kept saying that Canadian funding, you know, is coming and all that. So there was that as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I only think that's amazing because in Alberta, our government launched a crusade, I don't know, a witch hunt against environmentalist groups. Right. By saying there was foreign funding coming, funding those groups against the interests of Alberta. And simultaneously, the Indian government is saying these foreign funded groups are working against the interest of India.
Historically, the Indian government, and it's not just this government, has always said any protest, foreign funding. And when it's like a protest involving Sikhs, then it's Canadian funding. So, and that's like standard.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. You can't do Pakistan for, you can't blame Pakistan for the Sikhs. So you gotta.
You can't. No.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Good. Healthy. All right. Okay. Yeah. So that's a strange coincidence then. Yeah. Okay.
There's another thing in the appendix to the book, like, of course, like the land reform, you know, movement in the book is based on certain moments in Indian history, not the present one, but in Indian history. So yeah,
it's a huge, huge group of people, right? Like the farmers of India are a huge and very important contingent of people, not just for India but for the world. I believe they produce most of the world's cotton, right? They're a large.
Large
percentage of it. Yeah. So
when I was reading this book and thinking about the wall, and at least in my memory, the wall was very much sort of an idea of not just the imagined scarcity that we have in the world today, but a world of actual real scarcity in many resources. And obviously that theme carries over into the horizon. But instead of sort of focusing on the scarcity of it, I thought this was more focused on sort of the political control going on in the city and the various groups that were like, rather than actual real constraints, what are the political constraints and the social constraints we've put on ourselves, and how much sway does that have? Is that right? Is that a different sort of exploration you were making?
Yeah. So in the sense that even when you have a situation of actually existing scarcity, there are different ways that you can organize social life to deal with that, starting from the conditions of production to distribution and then to reproduction as well. And in somewhere like they have chosen one particular method, which is, you know, like the political governance is with the council, and a certain economic structure, and the conflict arises from people trying to imagine a different economic structure that then comes up against the political constraints of, you know, the ruling class resisting that. So yeah, it was in that way. Much more to do with how the various political imaginations that can take place within this context of scarcity.
It felt accurate, and it felt very compelling the way that it was described, of like the ruling class willing to make concessions that weren't really concessions, like concessions as long as it didn't affect them in any real way.
Yeah,
seemed to be as far as they were willing to go, and that seems to match the world around us.
Yeah, unfortunately so, yeah.
Well, very, very early in the book, like the council has to decide if they want to ban the young Teraphians, the political, yeah, the upstart political movement, and they don't do it, right? They decide that actually it's politically expedient to keep them. I thought that was very interesting. There's a tendency to have like this one dimensional cartoon villain version of political authority, and that it's not so, that they're not one dimensional. They're groups of people, and they have fights with each other, and they have agendas that are not just, they can sometimes have complex and contradicting agendas. Yeah. And that, you know, and sometimes they, when they're smart, they're actually capable of using political dissent in their calculus. I think there's something that like people in opposition movements sometimes forget, and can find themselves actively being co-opted and used by the powerful. And I think that's like in this room. And also the people you're fighting are not necessarily the people you're fighting. I don't want to spoil it, but there is this, there's the Shorna, like the military.
Yeah.
And you kind of think like, and of course, like the thinking of the young Teraphians is like, oh, the military are they're our primary enemy. They're the primary constituent of the conservative political agenda. But maybe they're not. maybe they too are taking are subject to a deeper level of conspiracy or agenda.
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of things. I think one is that I think the scene you're referring to, that so when in the wall there is this big trial where, you know, they're trying to ban the young Teraphians from going over the wall, or trying to go over the wall, and it ends with a riot. And that, of course, scares everyone. And so, of course, the assumption is that then they will vote, the council will vote to ban the Teraphians in order to, you know, preserve public order, and then they don't in the opening chapter. I think you're obviously right that there is a pragmatic calculus there. But I think also for me, it's about showing that at various points, governments or ruling bodies can even end up doing the right thing, even out of a sense of principle, knowing that this could come back to hurt them, which in this case it does. It does hurt. The decision to not ban the young Teraphians does end up hurting the council in various ways through the book. And I think one particular historical example that I'm really struck by is that of Mexico and slavery, I think, which was in a certain sense playing on my mind when I was writing this chapter. I read a book called South to Freedom by the historian Alice Baumgartner, which discussed the southern route that slaves took down to Mexico to escape slavery. And one point that she made was that even at times when the Mexican government was fully aware that that having outlawed slavery in Mexico and giving sanctuary to these fleeing slaves would ensure that the U.S. attacked them, that they would lose territory, that they would be seriously, their interests would be seriously compromised, they nonetheless at all times stuck to maintaining this principle of no slavery, even when it was clearly going against their political and economic interests. And Alice Baumgartner writes that, you can see that there's the times in history when people in power do end up doing the right thing for the right reasons. Not often, yes, but it does happen. So one thing actually I wanted to explore was that here's an instance of where this otherwise antagonistic council or government, which is opposed to the young Teraphians, impatient with them, is committed to maintaining its own power and maintaining public order. Nonetheless, when faced with this very obvious clash of principles, does end up going the principle route and the fallout of that. So there was that idea there as well. The other idea, and this is interesting you bring it up because I just read this today. Again, I've forgotten who it was by, but it was that that the ruling class will always tolerate political democracy as long as there's no economic democracy. There's a lot to unpack over there. But again, one idea is that it's okay for you to tolerate like dissent in political terms as long as the economic foundations of your rule are secure. So you can have all of these people going around saying you want to breach the wall, you want to go beyond the wall. It's fine, safety valve, of letting off steam, as long as like your basic like economic foundations are still unchallenged. So that was another idea I was playing with in that opening chapter, where they, to everyone's surprise, vote against banning the group despite all the pressure they're under.
Really, this book is about political. It's about revolution, right? Kind of like social and political revolution. And I feel like reading this book, you know, it was very refreshing, because I feel, you know, living in the gilded cage of the English language and reading in the Anglo discourse, you know, revolution has a mystical, venerant status that is very, very, very far removed from the parts of the world where actual revolutionary activity happens, right, to the point where, you know, often Anglo societies see real revolutions happening and are like, ooh, do not want. No, thank you. Gross. and you know, I think, like, yeah, so it's just really refreshing to have like a revolution, you know, to have like this idea that's like, yeah, and then we sang a song, and then everyone saw the truth and revolution happened, la la la, like, you know, to be like that, but like revolutions are actually like messy and hard to control, and they happen on a bunch of different levels, and they affect everyone differently. They are costly, right? If you don't, you know, I believe this is a quote, but maybe you did write it, but it's like, you know, the revolution demands all of your heart. You know, you have to give everything to the revolution. Like you don't do revolution on the weekends, because it is so costly and so intense. Yeah.
I think one thing definitely I've thought is that in speculative fiction, fantasy in particular, less so science fiction, obviously conflict, military conflict, you know, you see the overthrowing of tyrants, you know, it's a very common theme, kind of in pitched battles and an epic scale. What you don't see that much is urban insurrection and urban revolt, which was actually, you know, it seems that a lot of this stops around the 16th century. If you were to, you know, kind of compare with our world, and all of the really consequential urban insurrections that roiled Europe, you know, 1700s onwards, France of course was the main, but Belgium and so on, even in England a bit, you know, all this urban insurrection that was really aimed at fundamentally restructuring society, gets a pretty short shrift, like in speculative fiction and fantasy. The very, of course, outstanding exception is Night Watch, Pratchett's Night Watch, which, you know, is an exemplar of revolution in fantasy. So I wanted to do that a little bit of justice, you know, because I felt that that's really a neglected set of historical events. Fantasy hasn't really drawn enough. SF hasn't really drawn enough from that bit of our history. So that was one motivation. And the second, of course, was that you can explore, as you said, you can explore so many conflicting interests, especially in the context of political economy. Like, what is the revolution trying to achieve in terms of changing the political economy, and to what extent can it succeed given the structural and institutional constraints, and given that any successful revolution needs coalitions, and coalitions always will mean compromise. You know, so are you able to ultimately maintain your initial goal of actually radically overhauling the political economy, which is the initial goal of this revolution, or in order to actually have a shot at winning, are you forced to give up the more ambitious parts of your desire to overhaul the political economy and then settle for something that is more incremental and more reformist? So I was keen to really explore that, which again is this really common feature in history of revolution, right? The original French Revolution, you know, goes from the 1793 constitution that is so radical, and then the Thermidorian reaction and so on, right? So this seems to be a common history, that revolutions begin with radical dreams, and as they begin to succeed, they become more and more conservative, because they need to then, you know, do various things to stay, to kind of keep that success. That was the second thing I wanted to explore in the course of writing this revolution in this book as well.
Yeah, so that's kind of like the role that Rama plays, right? Kind of being like going from being political radical to being inside, more inside the political.
Yeah, so that's the role Bella, when she enters the council, you know. So in book one, she's, you know, she's obviously in thoughts and dreams as radical as Mithila is, and they're partners and so on. once she becomes a member of the council, and she's obviously driven by various other constraints, and she has to then make her own compromises. But even on the other side, even on the revolutionary side, you know, in the beginning, they start with these grand dreams and desires. And they realize that ultimately, if that is going to be their rallying cry, then they will only be able to get maybe the support of two or three of the circles, which won't be enough to actually to succeed. And to bring in, and if you have like this kind of class-based society, to bring enough people in to win, you have to articulate a program that enough people can get behind, which needs you to drop some of your more radical demands. So that internal conflict in the revolution itself, among the revolutionaries, was also, I think, as important to me as the conflict between Rama, who's now gone from being, you know, a revolutionary dreamer to a state, to actually a politician. I think both were equally important.
Because there's an actual scene where they're writing out their new charter.
Yeah.
And they all agree that, like, the first part is we're allowed to leave if we want to leave.
Yeah.
And then the second and third parts end up being much more contentious. They're like, the Duma wants widespread, and the 11 and 12, who are even not that much more comfortable than the Duma, are resistant to that idea. And they say, they talk about, like, then the comfortable circles, you know, the ones who are laborers, but sort of like petty bourgeois.
Yeah.
That, like, you know, they own a shop, so, like, it's fine.
PMC, Marshall.
What?
Professional management class.
Right, yes. you know, so it's like these people have a job and they have a, you know, a comfortable home and everything is great for them. So they might want more, but they certainly don't want to lose anything.
Yeah.
But how do you bring them in?
Yeah, how do you bring them in while keeping on board the Duma that, you know, that has nothing to lose but everything to gain? So that, I think, that tension, and I think again, when you think of revolution, that's something, I mean, the really boring part of it, of, you know, like getting that common program that everyone agrees on, the committee meetings, the compromises, you know, like striking off one sentence, putting in one clause, because without that, X or Y will not come on board. So again, you know, you don't often see that discussed that much in fantasy. So I thought it was just fun to explore, you know, the internal wranglings that kind of create a revolution and give it a fair shot of success, and how much kind of backroom work has to go into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that process of political coalition building is not the same as the idea of centrist compromise. Right. Like, right. That, like, you know, there's like, because I think what happens is, like, that reality about, like, political change is often like thrown around as being like, oh, that's why the two establishment political parties have to agree. But it's not true for them, because they are, again, the established political parties. They have the power. They don't need to build political and political and constituency power. They have it already. So Rama kind of ends up being the reverse of Mitterrand.
I thought it was interesting how quickly they were, like, the political class was able to sort of own Rama, and how willing she was to sort of, because she still thinks she's fighting for her ideals.
Yeah.
And saying, like, yeah, we can still breach the wall, but just not today.
Yeah. No, I think it's a good point. I think it comes from the idea that that human beings in general are very, very easily able to convince themselves that what they're doing is right, and rationalize their actions. So in the case of Rama, what she sees is that in the first half of the book, she sees how close Sumer is to falling into a theocracy, becoming a theocracy, and how, you know, how easily the kind of society they've built, which is broadly stable, can just crumble into this rule of the Shurtan priesthood and then just completely become a religious society. And then her overriding purpose is to put a stop to that, to stop that outcome, so that then they can have a shot at whatever else they want. But her first goal is to stop the religious fundamentalists from gaining power. And in the service of that goal, everything else can be postponed. because in her view, if that happens, everything else is lost. Whereas if she wins, if her side wins, then they can still negotiate and talk about everything else. But if they lose, then that possibility is gone. And so she uses that logic to justify to herself what she's doing, why she's fighting against Mithila, trying to destroy the revolution itself. So it's more, that's the kind of thought process she has during the revolution itself.
I'm with her entirely when she's, you know, facing down Meenakshi and fighting the Shortans. That makes 100% sense. And then she uses that same logic, though, against the revolution. And you're like, well, but they could be your natural allies here if you actually still hold that goal to be true. You could side with them and actually achieve it. But she's like, no, I'm so set on like consolidating the power that I can't actually reach my ultimate goal. And so then it felt to me like she would continually say for the rest of her life, yeah, we're going to breach the wall, just not today.
Yeah, I think it's a fair presumption of what she would say if the story was to follow a trajectory of the pen.
No.
It's history that's instructive. I think that in a way that again I'm thinking of you know the Indian independence movement and people like Nehru, who were very vocal about revolutionary programs and socialism and very very widespread and large scale redistribution of land among other things when they were under colonial rule and fighting for independence. And when they get independence and then suddenly they're now in power, they're the power holders, what you see is this idea that, okay, now we have power, we are good people, we will use it well, but just like give us the time to actually be able to use it well. And in that process, they end up actively suppressing more radical movements. So in the appendix to the book, I mentioned that the land reform movement in the book is inspired by this movement in West Bengal called the Tebaga movement that actually was agitating for 2/3 of the produce to go to the farmers. That's where this 1/3 rule in the book comes from. And that was like a very militant movement that was actively suppressed by the colonial police and then by the independent Indian police. And at the same time, in another part of India, in Telangana, you had like a communist movement that was actually all about radical land redistribution. And they were very violently suppressed by the independent Indian government, again, acting in the belief and perhaps the well-intentioned and sincere belief that this incremental way was a better way and that could actually help to sustain social order, economic order, political order. Even when well-intentioned revolutionaries attain power, there seems to be something about the holding of that power that then makes them, you know, a little more conservative, where then they suddenly start looking at this, they start seeing constraints everywhere, and they no longer want to kind of, you know, be as radical as they were when they didn't have power.
Like Churchill's famine in India in the 40s.
Yeah.
Absolutely, it makes the decision to push back against, you know, agricultural distribution reform such a knife, such a cruel way to be stabbed.
Yeah, I mean the Bhaga movement, I mean, in certain ways directly stems from the Bengal famine. I mean, it's in the same area, same place, and the people involved in it have instant like memories of like 3 or 4 years ago from the famine. So it's all happening in the same area in Bengal, which of course becomes partitioned at independence, becomes West Bengal and East Bengal, and now Bangladesh, then Pakistan, and then suddenly across the border you have two different Bengals. But yeah, like it's the same place.
I think it's something that I've it seems like you have in the work of yours that I've read, and maybe I'm. Let me know if I'm over reading here, but solidarity, and like the idea of class coming together and really like working with each other, seems to be something that you like to explore.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that one thing I've written about in my capacity as a reviewer, is that I think that this is not, of course, a criticism of any particular work, but there is a tendency, I think, in contemporary SF of problems being solved by the heroic action of either an individual or a small group. And something I found even in SF I really enjoy and love, that just ultimately at the end of the day, it is either, you know, brilliant actions of one person or of their small group that kind of turns the tide and changes things. And you see very little space for collective action of that kind, of the union kind, the collective movement kind, that actually makes a difference. And so, yeah, one of the ideas was to try and explore that, to actually look at like coalitions, something like a union. In fact, the Farmers Union, you know, is directly, the name itself comes from the anarchist union in Spain, Spanish Civil War. So the idea of exploring like class solidarity and unionizing and trying to solve the problem through solidarity was an idea I wanted to explore further in the book.
Yeah, and it comes up also in Oromai's Choice,
yeah,
where it's like that is the theme.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
yeah,
like
robot union than that, yeah. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
A robot union, but then also gaining solidarity from people outside of there.
Yeah.
Like in Oromai's Choice, it's like they're willing to put it all on the line.
Yeah.
With the explicit hope that there will be solidarity from others as
yeah.
well.
Yeah. Because they in Oromai's Choice, the success of their strike, not just metaphorically, but in a literal sense, depends on in an algorithmic sense, depends on solidarity. So
yeah.
I really
enjoyed that. It was a great demonstration of what people do put on the line when they go on strike and what they rely on. As humans, we're not going to be, you know, immediately like shut down.
Yeah.
To meet the demands of the owner class, but in a way we are that if workers don't get, you know, the basic necessities that they're looking for, they may as well be shut down.
Yeah, I think it's more, you know, Oromai's Choice is a more starker and explicit version of what's at stake in a strike. It's just that the consequences are immediate and direct, as opposed to perhaps being spread out over time.
Yeah. So this is why I love this book, because it's very germane to our current political moment, kind of regardless of what country you live in. you know, like it's very much like these are problems we have to solve. And I think in the case of like the English speaking, you know, world, at least, we are not even beginning to think about these things. Like, we don't even know to ask these questions, you know. And so it's I think it's really good that this book is out there and for people to read it. Because, yeah, it's like, what are the political coalitions that need to be built? And that also stands in contrast to making everyone happy or being popular, right? you don't need everyone to like you. Or, you know, to have a very powerful political coalition. And this is, I think, one of the things that stymies often well-meaning progressive people when they are trying to confront the right. It's like, they're saying things that are so rude. You know, they're being, and they're lying, you know. I mean, they're doing many horrible things. And not that I'm saying we be more like the right on the progressive side. But, like, you got to understand that, like, they're not, yeah, they only work on the people that they consider in their coalition. Generally people of one race or class inside that country, but they know that they know their constituency and they mobilize them. We have to do that too, but only our constituents. The progressive constituency is going to be broader. It has to be.
Yeah. I think also exploring from that the idea that in a coalition everybody has to give up something and give up something of value. So it's not just you give up like something trivial, but you have to all give up something that you actually deeply value in order to make a broad coalition work. You know, and that idea. That, you know, it's either you give it up or the coalition breaks down. And so you're faced with that stark choice. And then saying that I'm not going to give it up because this is my deadline just doesn't work. I mean, of course, everybody needs to have some kind of a deadline, but you know, you have to be always aware that you'll have to give it up, give up something important to make the coalition succeed.
You were talking, Stephen, about the salience of this book.
Oh,
yeah,
no. I mean, I just have frustrations with having political discussions with people, and I read your book, and I'm like, yes, Gotham gets it. Gotham gets it. Oh, finally. Yeah. And especially coming off of some of the things we reviewed Don't Look Up recently.
Okay, you know, okay, right.
It's a soothing balm to have on my on my eyes after watching Don't Look Up. Because Don't Look Up, I think, tries to say a lot of the same things you say, but can't say it because it doesn't understand it. But you do. You can understand it with much more clarity.
Right? Don't Look Up is ultimately a work of pessimism in that way. And it I think its premise is that we're not going to be able to actually build those coalitions, because ultimately there is just too much bad faith and entrenched interests that will prevent those. That's one way of I guess looking at things, and there is a more optimistic way, and I think I personally belong to the more optimistic school, even though circumstances, you know, perhaps make that a little naive. But I think this brings us back to the whole Ursula Le Guin idea, right? That, I mean, your job as a writer of speculative fiction is to show the alternative, what it would look like. And so, I mean, there's enough pessimism in the actually functioning world. So, I mean, the job then, I think, is to show how it might work in a more optimistic way, which of course isn't the same as perhaps utopianism that doesn't factor into account those difficulties. But yeah, you know, I guess maybe it's a bit in Kim Stanley Robinson in his latest book does have that sense of actually like the countries of the world come together and do manage to address, you know, climate change, however an unsatisfactory way, but they do actually manage to do it. And he shows you how they could do it. So I guess that's, and that school of thought is or the school of writing is what I like to belong to as well.
Absolutely. You mentioned Ursula K. Le Guin. You mentioned Ursula K. Le Guin. I noticed one like Easter egg reference there. Were there more?
There was just the one. Yeah.
Just one. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, of course, like the dispossessed as like a framing kind of, you know, sort of ideas, it's always present. But the specific reference to a different book, like there was just the one Easter egg there. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I liked it. I read it and I was like, I get that reference.
there were quite a few of kind. In fact, Gary Wolf wrote a review of The Horizon in Locus in December. It was very affectionate and a nice review. But he did say that I'm so enamored of Tears in the Rain that I've ended up doing it twice or thrice over two books, the Tears in the Rain dialogue. So he said, yeah, he's, you know, we can tell he's a fan because it comes like two or three times in both the books. So yeah, I think one of the delights of I think being in genre is that you can do all these intertextual things for like your readers and kind of be in a conspiracy with them in that way, which I think is something that maybe more mainstream fiction doesn't let you do in that way, but genre really lets you do that in a very fun way.
Yeah, well, that was actually the other thing I wanted to talk about, is like this, and again, you mentioned it in the afterword of the book, but like this idea of like, you know, intertextuality, and like, because one of the things is this kind of like it's very Platonic, like it draws a lot on Platonic work, you know, like it's kind of like the Republic meets the Ramayana, you know, in this. So, which is very cool. I think it's very cool to see Plato's kinds of ideas about waking up and philosophy and wisdom and insight are very foundational and very important. Mm-hmm. They're also very easily co-opted for tremendously evil and fascistoid ends, right? Like, we are the awake people, therefore we can do whatever we want to those fucking sheep, right? So it's, but it's good because I think I don't know the reminder very well, I'm probably mispronouncing it even, but you know, it's more, much more about love and the power of relationships, and you know, like which is I think like the good balance for the Platonic
Yeah, I mean, I think that like just that the Ramayan is an epic that it is composed of so many stories. They'll always find something to counterpoise whatever it is, like kind of flat, you know, flat narratives as well. So there'll always be something there. In both the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, the two major epics in India, they're just so sprawling that within them, if you want, you know, to find, and I think this is true more of the Mahabharata than the Ramayana. The Mahabharata is actually emotionally and politically and economically a much more complex text than the Ramayana. And so I think whatever it is you're looking for, like you will find something in one of those two epics to serve as material. And in my case, I mean, I think in the case of every Indian writer, it's more a question of this hybridity because, you know, when you're growing up and if you're walking into an Indian bookshop, you will see like Plato's Republic very, very prominently displayed, you know, in a very glossy edition. You will see like in secondhand bookstores, in fact, and in firsthand bookstores, you will see Sophocles, Aristophanes, Euripides, like they're all there, very, very prominent. At the same time, Ramayana is something that will just come into you by osmosis because it's all around you in the public culture. And so you almost can't help being influenced by both things. And that inevitably finds its way into your writing. So I think one thing that really is a personal annoyance for me is that when presently in genre, people keep talking about like this India-inspired, like, you know, spec fic, India-inspired X, Y, Z. And India-inspired is somehow always this kind of pristine, you know, myth kind of thing with something about the Vedas. And it seems to be this kind of an India that's stuck in time, an imagined India stuck in time somewhere in the heavens. But like Indians have grown up in India, and obviously I mean like English-speaking middle-class or upper-middle-class Indians, because these are the kind of audience and the writers here, right, are just subjected to so much hybridity in what influences us. It's never like this idea of this pristine, you know, India that is free of you know, Western taint that seems to be the way that the industry seems to understand India-inspired right now.
Yeah, there's this tendency to exoticize the other.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up religious and we have a lot of a very fraught discourse with Christianity here. Yeah. I imagine, you know, there's you know, with the kind of Vedic inspired religions, they kind of perform some of that same purpose over there, right? Like I think sometimes people, the conservatives, yeah, the people are bumping up against are, you know, tend to be from those religions.
Yeah. It has of course become much more pronounced over the last 7 or 8 years. It was much more under the surface pre-2014, before the election of this present government. So it's become much more pronounced. But yeah, the fault lines have always been there.
Moving back, because we said we were going to talk more about Aruma's choice as well.
Oh, yeah.
Was that story sort of inspired by the present time? Because we're seeing more and more strikes and large-scale strikes that we're seeing in the world that are being successful as well. Is that sort of like a inspired by now?
I guess in a way, yes. But also I think it was something I wanted to write for a long time. You know, writing about a strike in a science fiction context was something I've been wanting to do for a long time. So the way the story came about was that Mint, which is our kind of one of our national newspapers, they do a fiction special every January 1st. And this time the theme was regeneration, and they wanted like a science fiction story, a specific genre story. So they asked me to do a science fiction story that it was in some way connected to the theme of regeneration. And so I thought this is the ideal theme to have to write about a successful strike. So that's how it came about. But you, of course, you're right in that the fact that strikes have become a much bigger thing of late, and specifically strikes in the context of disrupting supply chains, have become like so salient over the last 3 or 4 years. That was definitely playing a big role in my mind when I was thinking about how to write about the strike.
Mm-hmm. Man, I hadn't even thought about like supply chain impact strikes. Like the capital class has made themselves very vulnerable with this like delivery on demand system that they've set up.
And also just like, we've talked about it before, but supply chains in the world are very efficient right now, which is great when everything is running smoothly. But when a ship gets stuck in the Suez Canal, it gets ruined. And just imagine if workers decided to go on strike by sticking ships in the Suez Canal and said, ah, well, we're on strike, so we stopped piloting the ships that are carrying the containers all over in these very precise lines, right? And all of a sudden, that supply chain breaks in a hard way because it's so efficient that any one thing going wrong ruins it.
Yeah. Yeah, this fantastic book called Planetary Mine, which is primarily about the mines in Chile, Potosi, and those places. But what it talks about really, really interestingly is I mean, from the mines in Chile, the entire like supply chain that goes, you know, ultimately where the copper features. And China and so on. So this is full. It traces the full line, and that's exactly the point it makes. That if you really want to disrupt, you know, capitalism or you know, kind of as a labor union or organize or get your demands, then the pressure points are in the supply chains, and you know, specific like. Preventing a ship from boarding at a dock, which I think was done recently on a couple of occasions, I think with respect to, I think perhaps carrying weapons or something, vague memories now. But yeah, so it kind of really shows, it maps the world, it gives the image of the world in supply chains. And it actually says that, I mean, it's common misconception to say that the sovereignty of states will give way to the sovereignty of multinational corporations. That's a very common mistake, because ultimately, it's the supply chains that are actually the core, and you will need states to guarantee that supply chains are still like functioning. So it makes that point very well as well.
I love Oromo's choice.
Thanks.
This is like a go-to recommendation.
So there's you know, he's one of those old school science fiction readers from like, he used to read like science fiction in the 1960s, and he said it. he's even in a good way. He's like, this reminded me of like the science fiction I used to read when I was a teenager. So
nice.
That way, yeah.
I am messaging him to make sure he puts the Horizon on his list of depictions of unions in science fiction. gotta get that on there. Yeah, so definitely check out Oromo's choice. It's we don't want to spoil it, but goddamn, it's very compelling. Good read and short.
Thank you. Yeah, there was a word limit of 2,000 words for the story, so it really really compresses.
It's tight.
Yeah.
What are you reading these days, or recommendations for other people to dig into?
Yeah, so I mean, most of my reading these days is around and about my own work in progress, which is kind of, you know, more science fiction-y. It's thinking more about, you know, like we discussed, you know, galactic civilization with a more anarchic style of governance. So of late, a book I read recently, which was very good, I found very good, was Alastair Reynolds' The Prefect. It was really good. I mean, and this whole idea of direct democracy and you know being the basis of the governance system was really interesting. So I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that a lot. I'm presently reading these two books, also in and around these issues. One is Peter Hamilton's The Reality Dysfunction. And it's really wild. Like it's got like it really takes that sentient spaceship theme and does all kinds of fascinating things with it. And it has a link between human and spaceship in very interesting ways. And the other is this book called Echopraxia. I think it's not massively well known, but also it's also again like it deals with all these themes. Around like neural like links, things like that are very interesting. So that's what I'm reading right now. In nonfiction, I recently finished this book called Economic Science Fictions, that is centrally about the link between, you know, economy and economic themes and science fiction. And it had a fascinating chapter on extraction and science fiction, you know, and what role extractivism and extraction and the idea of extraction has played in science fiction. So I'd recommend that. It's a very good book.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I can vouch for the prefect. Oh my God.
It was very, very it was compelling. It was very, very compelling. Yeah. I couldn't stop reading after a point. Like, what's happening? What's happening next?
You know? Yeah, it's also just a good whodunit too. Like it's like,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you just got a good mystery element too. So it's got it's very good. Alistair, come on the pod.
You should get him for sure, yeah.
Is there any advice you have to aspiring communists, revolutionaries, and other degenerates seeking to tear down the wall? The young Tarafians, sorry.
I mean, I guess, like, I don't know, it would probably be the same thing as you've talked about, that it wouldn't happen without collective action and coalitions, and it wouldn't happen without having to give up a lot of your original program. So to be prepared for both those things, to be able to, I think, have a hope of success. But I think that also, I think one thing that the history of the world, and in fact, the history of revolution, specifically urban insurrection, tells us is that it's power structures are always much weaker than we think they are, or when we fear they are, and there are always cracks, or internal cracks, and power is never a monolith. So that's always a cause for hope, I think.
Very true. Good advice.
Where can people get their copy of The Horizon?
Yeah, this is a good question. So right now it's an Amazon India, just both the Kindle version and the hardcover. I think in the UK and the US specifically, it's possible to order it from Amazon India, and it's not massively expensive. I think Canada as well should be possible. I'm still trying to get HarperCollins India to put up Kindle versions on Amazon UK. Sorry, I got that wrong. No, it is available now. The hard copy is available on Amazon UK and Amazon US, and I think Amazon Canada as well. The Kindle version is not, and I'm trying to persuade the publishers to put a Kindle version on Amazon UK and US as well. And Amazon is not ideal, of course. I wish there was another way to send copies, but it's pretty much the only website, I think, that's outside of India can be used to order the books. The issue is that right now the non-India rights are with me and not with Harper, and I'm querying it for, you know, maybe publication abroad. So if that happens at a later date, then it'll be much more easily available abroad. But right now, like I said, the hard copies are available on Amazon UK and US, and hopefully Kindle ones soon.
Let's get this adapted into a TV show. I think this would be a good Netflix series. Netflix, you owe us.
Yeah, that would be nice. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time, Gautam.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was great last time, great this time as well, and always a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
Yeah, when will the third? Is there going to be a third book?
No. So, well, not for now, at least. So now the duology is done. The story for now is over. I leave a kind of small possibility for future stories, but for now I've moved on to this new project, which is the more science fiction one. So for now the story is over. Yeah.
All right, great. Well, thank you so much. Have a wonderful rest of your day. I know our day is just starting, but your day is winding down. So
thank you.
Best of luck to you.
Thank you, and to you too as well. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Yeah, bye.
If you'd like to find out more about our show, Androids and Assets, you can find us on the internet, androidsandassets.ca. We're on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, at Asset Droid. Or you can send us an email, and we'd love to hear from you, info@androidsandassets.ca. The next time you're on a picket line, turn us on and listen to Gautam's wise views on collective action and solidarity and taking down the owner class.